Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For those who want it, the internet is a treasure trove of free movies, music, games, and software. But the creators of that bootlegged content don't do it for free. Those files are copyrighted, and downloads that ignore copyrights cut into their profits. Last week, major internet service providers started a new system to stem the problem. Joining us now to talk about that is Kevin Collier. He's a reporter for the online news site The Daily Dot. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Hi, Ann. Thank you for having me.
So it's called the Copyright Alerts System. Is it live now?
Yes, okay. Theoretically.
Okay. Meaning what?
Meaning it has had a lot of problems deploying on time. It officially launched Monday, the previous Monday. There's been very few actual instances of it actually flagging users yet. One of the participating service providers hasn't even formally made their announcement that they're in yet. So it's kind of a nebulous system so far.
So who is involved in the copyright alert system?
Okay, this is it's a joint agreement between two major content industries, the movie and music industries, mm-hmm. and then the five biggest internet service providers in the U.S., which is AT&T, Cablevision, or Optimum, Comcast, Time Warner, and Verizon.
And this is happening all over the place all the time. Are they just focusing on Americans, American
yes.
users? Okay.
Yes.
Why just Americans? Because some of the worst bootlegging is going on overseas.
The content industry, mm-hmm. the people who make the movies and music that we all love, they have so many different tentacles out trying to stem piracy. This is just one of many initiatives, but this is a big one.
Okay.
This is just they were able to get the big internet service providers in the U.S. to agree to this.
So you have to use AT&T, Cablevision, Comcast, Time Warner, or Verizon to get online at home. That's the people that it affects. What if I try to download illegal material or illegally download material that has different meanings, depending on how you say it? What happens? How do I get flagged?
Well, an interesting thing about this is it's really kind of like I said, it's kind of a Band-Aid thing. It really only looks for a very particular thing, which is if you use a peer-to-peer file sharing program like BitTorrent or Views. It's going to look for who's actually uploading certain files, and then it will flag you. It's hard to hide with those, but there's ways to hide yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're caught that way, then you're going to get an alert. But that's the only way. If you use any other kind of program, or any kind of other means of pirating, like for instance using a file locker site, this doesn't affect you at all.
And it's an automated, graduated response system.
That's right.
Yeah. So it goes from getting your hand slapped to getting what?
Well, yeah, the first two times it will just give you like a voicemail or an email. These things sort of escalate. That's why they call it graduated response. The fifth and sixth times that you're caught, and you know, you're not necessarily actually guilty when you're caught, but the fifth and sixth times, it varies from ISP. So AT&T, they're kind of vague. They say you're going to have to talk to them on an online portal. Cablevision will disconnect you for 24 hours. Comcast, Time Warner will lock your browser, won't let you browse the internet. And Verizon will just really slow your speeds to a crawl, to like dial-up speeds for a couple days. These are all temporary.
Okay.
Punishments, though they refuse to call it punishments. They call them mitigation
which
measures.
Which gets us into some other issues.
Yeah. Theoretically, they view it, the ISPs and the content companies view this as an educational system. This is just to combat the general culture of casual piracy in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to be something that will be part of your terms of service. In other words, there'll be somewhere you can look on your bill or go online to look at your bill that should explain this to you?
I believe all of the participating ISPs have made little announcements in the FAQ sections of their site, but it's also kind of, like I said, quietly implemented. They don't want people to be thinking critically about this and to be thinking of how you can get around it. That they just want to see, people to see hey, oh man, I got caught pirating. I'd better stop doing that. And then they will. That's what they're going for.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest for this segment of Tech Tuesday is Kevin Collier. He's a writer for The Daily Dot, and we're talking about the new Copyright Alerts System, CIS. It's an agreement between the five largest internet service providers in the United States and major content companies, music studios, the film studios, and so forth. If you have a question or comment for Kevin Collier, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you want to consider why this is necessary, you can we can hear from the Recording Industry Association of America says that in the decades since peer-to-peer, file sharing site Napster emerged in 1999. Music sales in the U.S. have dropped 47% from $14.6 billion to $7.7 billion. From 2004 through 2009 alone, approximately 30 billion songs were illegally downloaded on file sharing networks. That's just some major money, but there are concerns about systems like the Copyright Alert System. Kevin Collier, what are they?
Well, there's a couple.
Mm-hmm.
The first is there's a movement called the Open Wireless Movement, which is a group of sort of internet activists who want everybody to be connected, and then sort of as being a good citizen, you want to keep your Wi-Fi open to your neighbors. Now, this means that it opens up anyone who wants to engage in this movement to passersby, anyone who's using their internet access to this system, because the person who's going to get the alert, it's not the person whose computer is actually engaging in infringing activity. It's going to be whoever's paying the bill on an account.
Ah. So somebody could be filching my internet access.
Mm-hmm. And you will get the blame for it. It will be you getting the alerts, and then you, whose connection slowed to a crawl or blocked for 24 hours.
And the Open Wireless Movement doesn't get this? They're not concerned about that, or that is what they are?
They are. They're very concerned that this is going to hamper people's desire to participate. Another problem is that the software used, or the company that makes the software used to do this entire system, is like any copyright flagging software, problematic, and it has errors. And so people, I don't know if we have any examples yet of anyone being falsely flagged, but the same software has falsely flagged plenty of other sites for allegedly hosting copyrighted material, which was proven to be incorrect. So, for instance, kind of infamously, a month ago, the same software company flagged. They found a site that they said, hey, this site is hosting illegal HBO shows. They're streaming HBO content, and, we need to shut this pirate down. And that site was actually HBO.com. So it's an automated system that, that's not perfect.
A little overeager.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was going to take a call. Their question was, six strikes seems arbitrary. Again, is there any method to the way the copyright alert system is being put together? Could it change?
It could change. In theory, it's pretty settled to start with. Now, they've been working on this since July 2011. That's when they first formally announced it, and they just now got it started.
Wow.
So that tells you anything. And again, this is just looking for people. They're looking for people's IP address as they upload on a peer-to-peer file sharing program. So if you use a different means of getting files, if you can hide your IP address,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to see you.
Now, let's just talk about people who are not doing anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if they are flagged? Should they just ignore it?
No.
Okay.
Well,
what should they do?
And
they're not guilty of it.
Right. Right. So you are allowed to contest any of your alerts. It costs you $35 to do so.
Mm.
If you win, you go before the American Arbitration Association. If you win, you get your money back and the alert doesn't count. It doesn't count as one of your responses. If you lose, well, you're out $35.
Well, who's likely to arbitrate? I don't even know how the switch works to turn on the light. Yeah, I mean, who's going to arbitrate?
Well, the American Arbitration Association, which has done business with the content companies in the past.
But I mean, what's the likelihood that people are going to protest?
I think a lot of users are going to be, scared. Oh my gosh, I've been caught pirating, and want to
okay,
and quit doing it. And that's what I think. What they want, they know they're not going to root out piracy entirely.
Uh huh.
With this, what they want to do is they want to cut down any casual people who, just sort of, I'll download this song or movie, to get scared and then promise to never do it again.
So is there anybody out there wondering if this is legal to do this?
Yeah.
Like, I paid for my service.
Yeah. There's a White House petition that's gaining signatures right now. I've certainly seen people complain that they think this would violate net neutrality.
Uh-huh.
I would be very interested to see if this goes to court and how it would play out.
And it's just gotten started, so we have no sense really about how successful it is yet.
Right.
Are they reporting anything?
Are
the companies or not?
The content companies?
Yes.
Well, they also have been fairly mum about it.
Hmm.
Again, I don't want to be too accusatory, but I think that they're less interested in making it very transparent. Hey, this is the new system. It has its flaws, and more just they want to start gradually telling people, scaring people that hey, you don't want to. Well, we see that you're pirating. Stop, please, and try to convince them to do so.
What is the state, Kevin Collier, in your opinion, given what you do for a living and what you write about, the state of morality when it comes to content value and how people value it? I've never downloaded something illegally before. I wouldn't, not knowingly at least. Is there something different? Is this a generational thing? Is this just stuff people are trying to make money off of and they're actually stealing?
All of the above.
Okay.
I think the content companies want to use the word stealing to describe piracy, but there's a pretty key difference there,
mm-hmm.
which is that if I walk into your shop and I steal a box of Band-Aids, you no longer have that box of Band-Aids. But if I, pirate a song, I've not taken the song from you, I've copied it.
Right.
Now, I don't want to imply that I'm advocating for, you should be able to download any movie you want without paying for it or any album you want without paying for it. It's more of a problem that invariably any attempt to really shut down piracy on a mass scale always has these unintended consequences that maybe sort of interfere with the freedom of an open internet.
All right. Well, it looks like I'm probably going to hopefully have you back again, and we can catch up on this and see how it's going.
I'd love to be back. Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. Kevin Collier, he's a writer for The Daily Dot. We've just been talking about the copyright alerts system. It's gone into effect in recent weeks. Coming up, we're going to talk about how smartphone apps are out there to monitor your health and so forth and are making incredible advances in managing our health, but that there are some glitches, one being laws that were written to regulate such things were written back in the 1930s. So we'll hear more about that when we return to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
You know that thing that happens when something just becomes it? Part of that's luck and part of it's us.
Some of it is keeping up with the Joneses, talking about things that make us look good rather than bad, smart and in the know rather than dumb and behind the times.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The trick to becoming trendy next time on Marketplace. That and the rest of the day's business news as well. It's from APN.
Marketplace this evening at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. 34 degrees in downtown Columbus with some light rain today and a high of 38. And then that rain-snow mix becomes all snow overnight tonight, a low of 28 degrees with a snow accumulation of 2 to 4 inches possible. A little more snow for Wednesday morning, a high of 34 in the afternoon. Support comes from Assistive Technology of Ohio. AT Ohio is now accepting donations of used computers to be refurbished and made available to Ohioans with disabilities. AT Ohio offers a variety of disability programs and services, including a device loan library. Donation information is at atohio.org. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. There are all sorts of smartphone apps out there that monitor your health, your heart, your blood pressure, and more. Although these apps are becoming more and more advanced, they are governed by laws written in the 1930s when the apps of 2013 were inconceivable. Joining us now to talk about that is Morgan Reed. He's executive director of the Association of Competitive Technology and an advisory council member of the leading organization representing mobile health IT, the mobile health IT industry. Welcome to the show, Morgan.
Glad to be here.
It's called wireless medicine, and people are already using it. We've talked about it on the show before, but you wrote in a recent op-ed piece that advances in mobile technology are about to radically transform healthcare. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Well, yes. Every single one of us knows that we have a smartphone. We see them, all of your audience members, maybe even listening to this show on their smartphone. What's amazing about smartphone technology, just to give everybody a sense, level set, smartphones have the fastest adoption rate of any technology in the history of mankind.
Mm-hmm.
It's faster than the wheel, faster than the stove, faster than electricity. These devices are entering our lives at a rate that has never been seen before. But one of the things that's very interesting about them is they have an amazing number of sensors on them, sensors that tell us how fast we're moving, where our location is, how high we jump. People can play games on their phones by moving them back and forth rather than even touching anything. They have cameras that can do facial recognition. So from the standpoint of medical health, you've essentially taken a medical cart and put it in your pocket. All the sensors then, if you think about the old movies where they attach leads to people and plug them into the machine that goes ping, have that machine possibly in your pocket. So the problem we're facing right now is how do we take this device that has these sensors and maybe has more and move the kind of medical science that we want to have forward in a world where we do have some rightful concerns about privacy and making sure that our insurance companies aren't altering our rates based on what our cell phone is telling us. So there is a natural tension that's going on here and one that we have to respect. But on the other hand, the opportunity for amazing disruptive technology and, frankly, billions of dollars of money saving by the sensors that are on our devices is really right around the corner.
My guest is Morgan Reed. He's executive director of the Association of Competitive Technology, and we are talking about smartphone apps out there that monitor your health, that can be used to improve your health and manage your health care via the idea of wireless medicine. People are already using it. If you have a question for Morgan Reed, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You can tweet us at WOSU All Sides as well. So to give us a sense of this universe, how many of these kinds of apps are out there?
Well, we've already seen tens of thousands of apps that I would fall into the health category. There are ones that help you choose the right meals. There are apps that that are being pushed out into the developing world that allow you to take pictures of plants so that you can send it back to other agencies to say, well, what kind of bug is eating my plant, or what kind of fungus is growing on my plant, which, by the way, has significant health implications. We have apps that are already in place now for taking pictures of skin lesions that can report back to doctors, that are reviewed quickly on the device and then are forwarded on to medical professionals.
In other words, these are more than just a picture.
Yes, exactly. They do more than just take a picture in some cases. They actually analyze. There's one in particular that's pretty just profoundly amazing. The app itself takes a picture. You can take a picture of a skin lesion, and it measures the size, looks at the condition of the skin around it, and can start making some prognosis based on what it sees, which obviously is one of those really kind of out there science fiction, Star Wars kind of, Star Trek kind of thing. But ultimately, it's something we're going to have the ability to do. But I think in the more immediate time frame, for your audience members who might remember a very famous commercial, I've fallen and I can't get up, which is when an older person fell down and used a device to call for help while
clapper.
They're on the floor. Yeah, that's right. Kind of like the clapper. But here's what's amazing. Many of your listeners may have seen or heard of something called a Fitbit, which is a little tiny sensor that you can clip on your belt, and it measures how far you've walked and where you've gone for that day. But now imagine that that device now has a sensor on it that allows it, when it's in skin contact, to know if your glucose level is right. Do you have diabetes? What if it's monitoring for the heart rate? Now imagine that your mother or your father or your grandparent is not wanting to be at a stage where they need to be in a home or in assisted living, wants to live at home, but now you've had a device that they don't have to call out to say they're in trouble, but the device itself says, hey, grandma's glucose is a little low, or hey, we've seen a problem with her heart rate. And the device monitors, sends the information to the caregiver or to the doctor directly before there's ever an incident where they've fallen down and they can't get up. And so when you look at mobile health, that's not science fiction. That kind of sensor already exists, and now it's a question of getting it down to the right size and the right price point so that it can be something that enables living, aging in place in a much better and a more comfortable fashion than we've been used to.
And going back to what you mentioned as rightful concerns, making sure that it doesn't get into the hands of people who could use that information, people or organizations who could or might or possibly use it against you.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, you can probably tell from the tone in my voice, I'm enthusiastic and passionate about seeing these devices move into our lives. But by the same token, I am completely aware of the fact that we need to make sure it's done in a sane fashion. And so when you talked about regulation earlier, we need to make sure that the privacy laws fit. And then there's probably the dark horse issue on all of this, which is our wireless networks. You know, I've talked about all this stuff, and it all runs without wires. Well, that means it's running on the same network that transmits our cell phone signals, that transmits possibly our Wi-Fi signals. And those, frankly, are getting a little crowded.
So what does this have to do with my reference to the laws that were written in the 1930s? Communication laws, right?
Exactly. And so while your excellent radio station works within the bounds of the Federal Communications Commission and gets its license and is able to broadcast across the airwaves, those same laws that determine terrestrial radio also deal with questions of what kind of spectrum we have for medical devices, what kind of spectrum we have for unlicensed Wi-Fi networks. And you know, one of the things I joke about in this case is that video, which is wonderful on mobile devices, is really just a crusher for the network. If there was a busload of Bieber watchers coming by your house, simply 20 of them trying to watch HD video of Justin Bieber as they pass your house would completely saturate the tower that provides you your signal. Done. I mean, that would lock it down until they go by and they're off of your network. So heaven forbid they stop at a red light. Now imagine that the signal that's being carried across that is something that's medically relevant. It's one thing if you lose your call or can't get your email. It's another thing if the glucose meter doesn't report accurately or doesn't get to report at all just because there's a truckload full of Bieber watchers passing by your house. And so as we consider how we do this, we're going to really have to take into consideration a way to rethink the 1930s laws, make sure there's more spectrum available for what we term as IP networks, not intellectual property, as your previous guest, but IP as in Internet Protocol, and that there's more spectrum available, because we're never going to stop people from watching video.
So that we can set priorities.
Yes, and I think that we have to understand that setting priorities is a really hard thing for the government to do well. That isn't an anti-government statement; it's just a reality. One of my folks in the office says nobody likes technology at the speed of government. We often need government to provide some basic research and the underpinnings, as we did with the internet when it first started. But when we start getting on that cutting, bleeding edge, a regulation governing spectrum use might be better off being more open and more available in terms of being available for whatever kind of IP traffic wants to come across it, be it video or be it a glucose monitor. So more is probably a better solution than no. And that's, I think, where we all see the future heading. Because by prioritizing, it means telling someone no. And what might be better off is for us to have more so that we can tell everyone, sure.
Matthew in Whitehall, you're on the air with Morgan Reed. Welcome to the show, Matthew.
Thank you for having me.
You use an app to monitor your weight and your meals?
Yes. I'm an individual that's had to deal with type 1 diabetes for most of my life. And, you know, so that's a challenge, especially, you know, keeping track of the carbohydrates that I intake. Additionally, related to that condition, I have to deal with slightly elevated or high, at times, blood pressure. And I think, like many of us do, I have a goal to lose about 20 pounds. And I had come across this app. It's called MyFitnessPal. And what I found so interesting about it is it helps me with all three of those issues, because it basically has an index that contains most of the things you'd find in a grocery store. For example, like if you wanted to scan a barcode with it, you can, and it'll put the nutritional information right into your phone. But when you first start up the app, it has you put in information like your weight, your height, your goals, and it tells you exactly, you can tell it's oriented to people who want to lose weight because it tells you exactly how many calories you should intake each day to get to your goal. But I find it also very useful to know what the exact carbohydrates are. Even if the box is right in front of me, I have a log of that without having to actually write it down by just quickly snapping a picture of the barcode. And additionally, it has all of the restaurant food that you'd find at any typical restaurant. I mean, it's a little harder when you go to a locally owned place, which I tend to love to do. But there's also the option for that if you want to manually try to calculate what you're taking in by sort of adding up the ingredients. But
Well, I wanted to ask you what you think about what we've been talking about the privacy issues, and particularly when you're talking about, checking glucose levels and those kinds of things, not having the space to get accurate information. What do you make of what we've been discussing?
Well, you know, with the privacy issues, I guess maybe it's not such a concern for me. I've had this disease my entire life, and, you know, it's all over all of my medical records. So it's not necessarily possible for me to, for example, conceal that I have diabetes from a future insurance company. You know, that's something that I have to disclose because I have to rely on that insurance company to.
Yeah, you know, Matt, I think the thing to think about is in your condition, and by the way, congratulations on finding an app that helps, and he's right, MyFitnessPal probably has the best index out there of food choices. I think, Matt, the thing that we have to make sure that apps like what you're using can continue to grow, and I think the privacy concern may not be from the aspect of your insurance company or healthcare provider, but we need to make sure that the laws are in such a way that, for example, let's say that your insurance for your next house payment, the information about your diabetes is tied to your score at a large data broker who makes the decision that, look, we know that people with type 1 diabetes die slightly more often, and therefore we want to increase the rate of homeowners insurance. I mean, there are certain things that we do need to take into consideration, and thank goodness you have found ways to manage it. But I want to make sure the technology continues to move forward, but that the right people have access to your information, and that you, Matt, get to choose who gets to have access to it and how it's used moving forward. I think that, and that's why we need to promote the heck out of good apps like you've just done, but we also need to make sure that the laws both don't get in the way, but don't allow for the kind of abuse that sometimes happens when people have access to everything all the time.
Now, Morgan, what you just described, I hadn't exactly thought of it that way. The way I was thinking of it was, well, what if you're not doing such a good job with your diet, but you're keeping track of all of it, and your insurance company gets a hold of that and says, you know, Matthew doesn't really have a good lifestyle. Maybe we should charge him more.
Well, unfortunately, that's a pretty grim reality, and it's probably something that happens regardless of whether or not you monitor it with a mobile device or not.
Mm-hmm.
We know that when you apply for life insurance, they take your blood and they don't really care what you tell them.
That's true. Okay.
I think the interesting part of this is that we are on this cusp of some really incredible disruptive technology around health. We all know, everyone on this call is aware that there's $2.7 trillion that we spend every year in our healthcare system. 17% of our GDP goes into healthcare. And what Matt just described him doing is probably saving every single one of us and everyone in your listening audience a penny or so a year individually, just Matt by himself. Maybe not a penny, but some, by Matt having control over what he's doing with his life and not having to visit the hospital as much, not visiting the emergency room. So we have to look at the kind of disruptive technology that this brings, not just for big victories and huge life-saving stories on the news, but the impact that his improvement in both his quality of life, but also the quality of his own self-care makes to our own pocketbooks.
Matthew, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Take care. Morgan Reed, thanks so much for joining us. It looks like a developing issue that we'll talk about again in the future.
Always happy to do so. Have a good day.
You too. Morgan Reed, he's the executive director of the Association of Competitive Technology, also on the advisory council of the leading organization representing the mobile health IT industry. Coming up, Russell Holley, tech blogger for geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to serve on the Supreme Court. When she graduated from law school in 1952, she called at least 40 law firms.
And not one of them would give me an interview. I was a woman, and they said, we don't hire women.
Justice O'Connor has a new book called Out of Order. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News. And join us for All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow for a discussion of Governor Kasich's tax strategy with State Budget Director Tim Keem. And then it's Wellness Wednesday. That's tomorrow in All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 a.m. till noon. Some light rain in the area, 34 degrees. Rain-snow mix for today and a high of 38. Some snow for tonight, 2 to 4 inches is possible, a low of 28 degrees. Support comes from Ohio Northern University, investing in the success of its students by offering more than $58 million in scholarships and financial aid annually, nationally ranked academics, and a 92% job placement rate are hallmarks of an ONU education. Explore Pharmacy Day is March 16th, onu.edu. And support comes from Ohio State's Ross Heart Hospital, helping to build healthy hearts with the 2013 Wellness Series. Heart disease is a leading cause of death in the United States, and regular physical activity is a great way to prevent it. Details about Ohio State's Wellness Series are at go.osu.edu/series. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. One thing that makes smartphones so popular is having access to email, the internet, maps, and a camera all in one handheld device. We've talked about how the search engine giant Google is working to bring that same technology to a pair of glasses. And they've reached another milestone with Google Glass. Joining us to talk about that is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So we've talked about Google Glass before, but for the uninitiated, give us a primer again.
So this is it's Google's attempt at what is becoming increasingly commonly referred to as wearable technology. It's essentially all of the parts of a cell phone, you know, I guess without the ability to make calls, in a very small casing that you actually wear, very similarly to how you would wear a pair of glasses. And it takes, you know, just a little tiny piece of glass and uses it as a projection surface for data that comes, you know, comes in. So you get notifications and, you know, email and text messages and things like that. And instead of having to reach into your pocket and pull out your phone and look at these things, it presents it to you kind of as a silhouette just inside of your field of vision.
I'm always trying to imagine what that would be like. And now there is a way for someone to test it, drive one of these, or there's a list of people.
Last year when they first announced it, it was last year, Google grabbed a whole bunch of people and created what they called the Glass Explorers program, which is, you know, kind of a developer program for people who are going to help make applications for, you know, the glass prototypes and things like that. And they're reaching a point where those are going to be handed out soon. But what they did in the meantime was release a video that contains a series of interactions, you know, where you can see exactly what it would be like to use glass in certain situations. You know, the big thing is, you know, to be in an environment where your hands are full or you're driving or something where you really shouldn't be messing with your phone and you have the ability to take a photo, you know, just by saying, you know, glass, take a photo, and the camera, you know, on the side of your head will respond and take a photo and save it. And you can, you know, send it as an email or, you know, all of the same things that you would do with a phone.
Is there any concerns when you talk about driving and doing that, that you're going to be distracted? They already say that even, you know, hands-free, the Bluetooth technology isn't necessarily, it's still distracting.
Well, it's still distracting, but the biggest reason that it's still distracting is you still have to take your hands off the steering wheel.
Hmm.
When you are using a Bluetooth headset, you still have to reach up and touch the button on the side of your head to answer the phone. You still want to look down at your screen to see who's calling,
mm-hmm.
or you know, divert your attention to try and figure out what the little robot that's now plugged into your ear is trying to tell you is calling. You know, it's still a really imperfect setup for that kind of environment because, you know, especially when you're driving or riding a bike or doing something like that, both your hands are supposed to have, you know, both hands focused. So what the Project Glass setup, you know, relies almost entirely on voice recognition. You know, you're in an environment where you can speak directly to the headset and it'll respond and it'll do just about anything that you ask it to do, you know, including, you know, make the display go away when you're driving, you know, with, you know, just a lot of control that doesn't involve using the hand. And the display is never actually over your eye. It's never in a position where it's taking up, any of your line of sight when you're doing something like driving.
So you'd kind of have to look up a little bit or
look
down.
Glance up just a little bit, and there's the display isn't big enough to show information that is, you know, so long that you'd be taking your eyes off of anything for longer than a second. I mean, it's really just designed to show a text message or an incoming call or the next set of directions and navigation, you know, if you were using it as a GPS service.
My guest is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question for Russell about Google Glass or any technological concept, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page or tweet us at WOSU All Sides. So it'll be something, I read that it's something that you'll attach to a pair of sunglasses, but what about the rest of us? you know, you and, I think so, you and I, who really
exactly.
need glasses because I hate contacts, do you hear a whine in my voice? What about me?
So they've shown a couple of different prototypes now where the glass unit itself actually clips onto several different kinds of regular glasses because
okay.
the whole purpose is that it floats, you know, really just above where, you know, it floats just where the top of your, you know, the rim of your glasses are. So it's not really interfering or anything. And it's designed to flex to, you know, whichever user. So you'll be able to kind of fit it to whatever pair of glasses you have.
Is it something you could share?
It's something that you could take off and give to somebody else, but it's not something that I think you would ever really want to. This is something that is pretty hard-coded to you. I mean, it's not really like a phone where, you know, someone can use an app and do things where, you know, maybe they're not, you know, messing with any of your settings or your features. This is pretty much, you know, your personality. You know, it has your incoming messages, your incoming social network stuff. All of that kind of sits in a timeline that can be accessed, you know, without a username or password or anything like that. It's all pretty out in the open because it's supposed to be something that you're keeping on you. But it's not, you know, it's not specifically, you know, one person use. You could pass it around if you really wanted to.
Now, I was seeing reference to the idea of contacts. Is that in the realm of possibility yet?
There are definitely scientists working on having contacts that'll, you know, that'll do really clever things when they're hooked up to your eyes, but that's definitely a lot further out.
Okay. Now, some people have compared glass to the Segway, which is so mean. I personally have never, you know, been on one myself, but it's a cool idea that no one wants to use in public. It looks dorky or it looks weird. It looks like data from Star Trek or whatever.
It's definitely got a different look. You know, it's hard to look at somebody walking down the street wearing one of these and not think that something's going on. And you are wearing a tiny computer on your head. But I think that they've done a lot to focus on the style of it. So it's not really all that different from seeing someone wearing, you know, a pair of glasses. And it even has, you know, the sunglass attachment so that it looks a lot more normal and, you know, kind of outdoor use. But really, I think we're still a while away from a lot of people picking this up, you know, if for no other reason than the price.
Okay.
I mean, this is all pretty experimental, you know, technology. This is
yeah.
a lot of kind of new stuff. And even the people who are participating in the developer program, while this is expected to be the most expensive version, the developer program is still, you know, a pretty steep $1,500.
You have to pay to do it.
Oh yeah, because you're getting the setup and you're using it as you will. You're developing applications that you would sell. This isn't any different than, you know, smartphone developers who are, you know, building applications for iOS or Android or anything like that.
And do you anticipate just apps being created for this technology specifically?
I think that we've got a lot of technology that is waiting for, you know, the appropriate mechanism to deliver those applications. You know, we've talked
uh-huh.
a lot about things like augmented reality.
Right.
You know, the problem with augmented reality right now is that in order for it to be even remotely useful, you have to walk around with your phone up in front of your face and you kind of walk around and it's a cute little thing for a couple of seconds, but it's really not something that you would do, you know, full time. If you had something that was, you know, that was able to display that information regardless of context, regardless of situation, then I think that those kind of things, which we've seen a lot of little developments in, would finally have an appropriate home and become useful.
Harrison in Columbus, you're on the air with Russell Holly. Welcome, Harrison.
Thanks. So I tuned in and getting in my car about halfway through, so I apologize if this was covered. But, you know, does Google see Glass as a replacement for the smartphone for the Android system or as an extension to the Android system? I use it with my phone.
Okay, so Harris is asking, is it a replacement or an extension of what of the smartphone now?
So a lot of the interviews that have been done so far with the people responsible for the project have looked at Google Glass as, you know, kind of the personal arm of how you would use a smartphone. A lot of people take a look at smartphones and they have a ton of little things that you can do with apps and things like that. But The thing that you do most commonly when you pull your phone out of your pocket is you check for notifications, you check for email, you check for text messages and things like that. And Glass is kind of the interrupt, point where it receives those things and presents them in a way that you don't have to pull your phone out of your pocket every 30 seconds. So I don't know so much that it's a replacement, and I don't know that it's an accessory either. It's really kind of a separate thing that you could live without, certainly, but it provides that ease of use.
Thanks, Harrison, for that question. Russell, you mentioned earlier that everything but talk. So you couldn't use it
so
as a phone?
So at least the version that they're working on right now is specifically Wi-Fi only.
Okay.
So they have demonstrated things like a video chat that you can do on it where it shows in the glass field, what's going on. And the other people who are speaking to you via video chat can see what it is that you see. The first demonstration that they ever did of these in a public forum, they had someone jump out of a balloon and land on the top of the convention center in San Francisco. And you were able to see first person, that entire experience as he jumped out of the blimp and kind of sailed down to the top of the convention center. And it's a bizarre experience to be able to see things, from that first person view. But they haven't made any real noise about the ability to make phone calls or anything that would suggest that it's designed to replace a cell phone.
So many questions. So $1,500 at the outset, how fast are you expecting it to get to something, like I could afford?
I think that, what we're seeing here with the developer kit, there's going to be a lot of extra bells and whistles mm-hmm. attached to the developer kit as developers are trying to figure out what the best, use for this kind of technology is. Mm-hmm. So I think that the user version is probably going to be, $500 cheaper. And I think that the price will continue to go down dramatically as this kind of thing gets worked on. I think, for most people who are still paying $200 for a cell phone, we're at least a year away from this being something that's, kind of in the realm of something that's considered worth spending money on.
I always love it the way you put it in your time in terms of, I thought you were going to say it's at least a year. As if it would be like 10 years to me.
So, I have a terribly warped sense of time.
It's so funny.
I've learned that from you.
It always cracks me up. Oh, it's way off. Well, how far off? Oh, about 3 weeks. Oh, okay. let's, turn from the talk of how much of that will cost to Apple. Kind of small change, but there's a class action lawsuit. Well, it's not small change to Apple, but it would be to the beneficiaries. There's a class action lawsuit created to address the issue of children who are encouraged to spend their parents' real money for play money in the virtual worlds in which they play. What's going on there?
This was something that came up, when in-app purchases became something that was a new feature for iOS and Apple's, a whole line of products. And the idea sounded really great at the time. You could present, let's say you're looking at a magazine through your iPad, and something comes up where you're taken to an advertisement for, some body lotion that you want to try out. You can actually pay for the sample, or you could pay for the product, inside the application without having to leave and to go to a shopping cart or anything like that. And it would be a really kind of seamless interaction. And mm-hmm. It is. It's a wonderful way of, keeping you focused on, the thing that you're doing without distracting you, without removing you from the thing that you're doing. Unfortunately, when you give that power to a child and you tell them that for a sum of money that they don't functionally understand, they can have, a certain amount of extra toys that they need in order to, proceed on to the next level in the game that they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't, originally the problem was that this wasn't protected by a password. This wasn't protected by any kind of security system, because all of your information was already stored with Apple. And the result was a significant rash of parents who, checked their bank statement the next day and found that their son or daughter had spent hundreds of dollars accidentally on, in-game equipment for games that they were playing. And this isn't exclusive to the iPhone. This has happened on any platform where there's microtransactions like this. But it was something that a lot of people really kind of wanted to see Apple fix, and it took Apple a pretty significant amount of time to fix.
So they've fixed it, but that wasn't enough. Some people want their money back. Well, how much money are we talking about?
I mean, for some people, it was as little as $5. And there's one big case that gets focused on a lot when this discussion happens, because it was $2,500. And it really ranges all the way in between. You know, there's you know, hundreds of dollars in these microtransactions that happened. And, you know, Apple created this environment so that, you know, it would be nice and simple and easy to do, but also so that Apple could get, you know, a cut of that transaction when it happened. And so, you know, they looked to Apple to kind of fix this. And they did. You know, now there's a password. Anytime you want to use a microtransaction, you know, you have to enter in your iOS password.
And that's something that a parent should not give their child.
You should definitely not give that to your child, because it's the same thing that you use when you're downloading an application that you have to pay money for, or if you're buying something on iTunes, because it's the same password for all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, if you've given someone that password, it's really, really easy to see that number get racked up. And so if you have, if you're able to prove that you had a child that was involved, you know, in the list of applications that Apple has, and it's, you know, something like 150 games that were involved in at the time, then they present you, you know, with the option to either get, you know, up to $30 in iTunes gift cards, or they'll, you know, translate it to cash for you.
So when should people start seeing this?
Right now, it's something that Apple will address in an email to iTunes subscribers.
Okay.
More than likely by the end of the month, but they haven't set a firm time for it. And what will happen is, if you have an iTunes account and you've had an iTunes account that has made transactions during the period where this was an issue, then Apple will email you, and you know, you'll be told that you're entitled to this if you can prove it, and they'll have the steps necessary in order to prove it. And then they'll start giving out, you know, the refunds where it's applicable. I don't think most people ran into a problem more than, you know, $10 or $15. And even then, I think that that's something that most people, because this has been, you know, a little over a year, I think most people probably would shrug off $5 or $10 in-app purchases by now. But there were definitely some significant fringe cases where hundreds of dollars were lost.
We've got a couple emails going back to the Google Glass. This is from a safety-conscious listener, an email. All of the scientific studies I've seen show that just being on a cell phone, no hand use, is very distracting to the brain, as distracting as drinking and driving or worse. I worry about this distraction of Google Glass. And an email from Isaac. I think smartphones are getting better and, of course, faster, and will become a bigger part of our lives. We bank with them, we make our lives healthier, and we have the web at our fingertips. And now we will be physically connected to our smartphones with the Nike Fuel Band, and now with the Google Glass. They have to be user-friendly, of course, have an ease of connectivity and long battery life. And I'm sure that we will continue to talk about them, right, Russell?
Absolutely.
All right, Russell Holley, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. The All Sides staff helped out as well. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producers Corinne Gleckler and Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban and Leticia Wiggins, with video production by Rich Karsminski and Amber Karsminski. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.